and welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. I'm your host, Lori LeBay, and I'm so excited that you're joining us today. We are going to have a fascinating conversation, as usual, as we learn from people all around the world at all ages and stages of life. Stay tuned as we shift our dementia care from crisis to comfort.
Here we go. What you think about?
Well, hi, everyone, and welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. I'm Lori LeBay, your host, and today we are going to be talking about navigating the maze and unraveling the challenges of dementia caregiving. And anyone in this space understands the need to have this conversation. We're going to be talking with Darlene Fuchs today. She's written a book called Get in the Boat, a memoir of love and the dance with dementia. But before I introduce you to Darlene, I just always like to give a shout out to our website where we have free educational resources. So go to alzheimerspeaks.com. There is a large variety of resources, from tools to finding out about becoming dementia friendly and memory cafes, to dementia chats and dementia in the arts and our poetry section, and so much more. You'll also find access to Dementia Map, which is our global resource directory. And we invite you, if you are a vendor, if you have a service, product, or tool anywhere in the world, we'd love to have it listed there, as long as it's pertinent to dementia and caregiving. It's free for anyone to use, and you'll never be asked for any personal information. So you don't have to worry about getting spammed or hacked or bothered by us. That's not how we operate. We're just trying to make life a little easier for those living with dementia. Their families and professionals as well have found this resource directory very helpful. And it's open to everyone. So if you're a profit, a nonprofit, a government agency, or even a person who doesn't think that they're a resource because they're not a formal entity, many of you have written books, you have blogs, you have YouTube channels, and more Facebook groups and things. Everyone is welcome. So with no further ado, let's meet Darlene. Well, Darlene, I'm so excited to have you join us today. So first of all, thanks for taking the time. This topic is so important, and I know you're going to have some brilliant insights for us. I would appreciate it if you can introduce yourself to our audience, if you don't mind.
Well, people ask me, how did you get into caregiving? And it's not something that I can say I actually got into. Like many people out there, we grow up and we think of getting old and retiring with our partner and life goes on. Well, as many of us have found out, we get thrown into a caregiver role. And so I ended up leaving what I would say is corporate America, being a buyer, being a realtor, thinking that everything was going great. Until, yeah, all of a sudden, I got put into this situation in numerous different ways, just like so many other people.
Yeah, it really is not something people sign up for. It's kind of handed to them and said, do it.
Yeah, not something we learn either. I mean, yeah. You learn as we go.
Yeah, no instruction manual, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So you've been touched by dementia. Can you give us a little more detail as to who and how and when?
So it wasn't initially dementia that I ended up with caregiving. We found out that my father-in-law was suffering from terminal liver cancer. And I've found out over many, many years that caregiving is caregiving. I don't care why you're thrown into it, whether it's dementia, liver, anything like that, liver cancer. And he stayed with us for a couple months while he was in his final decline. And that was the very first time I found out what it was like to have to be somewhere 24/7, listening to a baby monitor, to their, you know, breathing and trying to keep someone comfortable in their final end stages. When he passed away, My mother-in-law, the wallflower child that she was, needed socialization and really opted to go into a full care facility that started out with independent living and transitioned then to assisted living and eventually full care. So I was a caregiver once removed at that point in time because I had to not only make sure that she was taken care of, but also that the caregivers taking care of her were hopefully doing what they should do. And when that ended, when she passed, I thought, well, I could get my life back together again. And overnight found out that my three-year-old grandson was suffering from medulloblastoma, which is a cancerous growth on the brainstem that was very aggressive. And now I'm dealing with a caregiving role with my grandchild, a child. My daughter was suffering. I couldn't put a Band-Aid on her to make her feel better and had to be the caregiver to the caregiver to the caregiver. And that was difficult, but very short-lived. And as fate would have it, when things turned around for me, I got a call from my dad. They had moved back to Illinois, or back to Connecticut from Illinois, and never thought I would get a call from him saying we're moving back to Illinois, because that was the reason they left to go back to Connecticut, was for the mountains and the ocean and all the things that they didn't like here. I knew something was wrong and didn't find out until they actually arrived that something was definitely wrong with my mom, but didn't know what dementia was at that point. And thanks to technology, was able to do some research and follow along. And the process was long. It wasn't just a couple months or a couple years. The last stages, the last 6 years, were probably the most difficult because she lost her language. And trying to navigate all the day-to-day changes that she was going through was definitely a learning experience.
Wow, you have been through the ringer and all the levels of care.
Different levels, but you know, it makes for a well-rounded person, I guess.
Well, and you were right, though, when you said caregiving is caregiving. And I think so often people separate it. And yeah, each thing has its specialty items that you have to care in certain ways, or personalities that you're dealing with, you have to care in different ways and stuff. But bottom line, you know, there's so many commonalities throughout the whole process. So what are some of the best ways you think people can support seniors, you know, facing dementia?
Well, it's a different ballpark. When you're looking at a child, they don't really understand what they're going through. And I think the norm for them, especially if they're younger, they think that this is what every child goes through. As adults, we understand and we see the changes that we're physically going through and mentally going through as we get older. And as caregivers, I think one of the biggest things that we can remember is respect that they're still a person. Everyone needs to feel a sense of independence that they can still cling on to. Even if that means that they can't do as much as what they would have done in the past. But we need to give them that ability to hold on to that sense. I think another thing is, you know, not just addressing the lifestyles for ourselves, but the lifestyles for our elders, like making sure their diet is good and making sure they're still getting some exercise, even if that only means that they could be in a wheelchair and you're taking them out and getting exercise at the same time. I find in dementia, that sense of feeling that you are in a safe environment is so important, because so many people with dementia stress over the littlest things. And if we can give, if caregivers can give them a sense that things are okay, and that means, you know, as little as having to do things like eliminate some of the hazards that may be in either your home or wherever they are staying, making the place more comfortable, and establishing a routine for them. I think with routine and respect and giving them independence, we'll have a lot easier time as caregivers, being able to engage in them for like social stimulation, trying to still keep friends or grandchildren or children coming by to engage with them once in a while. And I think overall, when we're looking at what we're able to do for them, I think if we just step back as caregivers and allow ourselves the ability to have patience and to not react quickly to whatever the situation is at that time, it definitely will help all of us with being able to give a better all over rounded lifestyle for them and make our job as caregivers a lot easier too.
Oh, I totally agree with everything you said. For my mom, I came up with a tool called Your Memory Chip when I wasn't patient one day and I snapped and I felt horrible. You know, I didn't have time. I was, exhausted and had way too many things on my list to do. And of course she forgot, but I never did. And so for me, I had to really focus on, was she safe? Was she happy? And was she pain-free? Those were my three priorities, because when she's calm and happy, then I could be calm and happy. And I didn't realize that when she was anxious, I was probably feeding off of that, and vice versa, how she was feeding off me when I was anxious. And, you know, one of the gifts I found in the disease, which I know people will sound weird, but it made me look inward at how am I being perceived by other people? How am I coming off? And how are they reacting? And taking some of the responsibility sometimes for her actions, where she was just mimicking me and I didn't even know it. You know, she was totally calm and comfortable before I walked in the door.
Well, just think about it. I mean, even with children, they emulate what their parents are doing. And I think we, especially with dementia patients, you know, they don't just read the tone of our voice. They definitely pick up on what our body language is telling them. Are we giving them eye contact? Are we speaking softer? You know, are we listening and giving them time? There are so many things that come into it. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, how do you know which one of those work? And it's like, well, you just keep on trying, because eventually, yeah, we all will find what sets our loved one off or makes them angry. Just like we're really good as married couples. I mean, I know even with my husband, I can be sitting across the room at a social engagement, and I can have an argument with him across the room without even saying a word. It's just my tapping of my foot or my glance or whatever. And I'm sure they're picking up on that just the same way.
Yeah. In my chats, I do a thing called dementia chats, where I facilitate a conversation with a panel of experts, those living with dementia. And they say, they kind of explain their senses like somebody who's blind or has hearing loss, where the other senses pick up and present themselves more to support them so that they can understand what's going on. So, you know, one of the things I always say is, you know, don't talk to me when you're behind me. I need to read your lips. I need to read your facial expressions. And we're just so used to somebody being able to hear. But that goes for somebody with hearing loss. It for so many different factors. If someone's had a stroke, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. It's just easier to read what's really being said when you can see. It's kind of like getting a text message. Okay, I can interpret this 12 different ways. Which way should I?
Yeah.
You know, and if you interpret it the wrong way, all of a sudden you've got, you know, these nasty texts going back and forth, and, you know, no, and then everyone goes, how do we get here? You know, because
exactly
with that. So, Yeah, I think that's slowing down, and you have to look for these things too, because I think we're so used to being unconscious about our mind just picking up and processing those things. But I found for myself with a person with dementia, I had to be consciously looking, slowing down, and then the puzzle pieces fell together so much faster. And I could correct things when they were out of whack. And, you know, I started saying, you know, it's not a behavior, it's a reaction, because they don't know how else to tell me. So I have to be the one to figure out, why are they not reacting how they normally are? Something's wrong, but they don't have the words.
Yeah, my mom, she would like, should sit on the table and tap her finger on the table. And it would be, you know, it's like Morse code, but, you know, it was her way of saying she wanted more of something, or she would tap and wipe, and you would know, like, oh, she's found something small on the table. She wants, you know, wants it to be wiped down again. But it is, you have to really, it's like solving a puzzle, or like going on some kind of a scavenger hunt. You literally are looking for things. And if you can be patient enough to pick up on some of the visual clues that you have and kind of put them in perspective and really get down to their level and communicate with them in such a way that they stay focused just on you and not on other things that may be going around on them at the moment, I think it becomes a lot easier as a caregiver to try and interpret in some way, or to guess what it is that they may be in need of or be afraid of, and to address those issues. Otherwise, I feel like sometimes we're just like a hamster on a wheel, and we're just getting nowhere. We're trying and trying and trying. But until we really take the time as caregivers to sit back and say, okay, maybe I need to jot some things down, you know, because I'm seeing this repetition, and what happened before and after. It's almost like, do I have a food allergy? You know, the doctors say, well, start logging everything that you have down so that you can take a look at it and see if there is an occurring food that you keep eating. I think it's the same way with dementia or any kind of caregiving role.
Yeah.
You know, we have to learn to communicate differently.
Well, and I think people don't take into consideration the senses and how that can trigger, you know, these reactions.
Oh, yeah.
I remember Harry Urban, who was living with dementia, saying he was getting really paranoid. And he kept thinking somebody was in the room, and he'd look and there was nobody back there, and he was getting agitated. And his wife saw that he was getting agitated. And what she realized was that there was the sun was moving, you know, between the clouds. And every time, you know, the clouds came out, he felt this darkness and he would look. And she ended up just shutting the blinds, and that stopped it. You know, because he couldn't put those things together. Or there was a time my mom was in the nursing home, and there was this one woman who, gosh, she had these beautiful crystal blue eyes. And she was in a wheelchair, and she had the tabletop, and she, like your mom, you know, except when she got frustrated, she'd bang on it and then she'd kind of scream. And the staff would just like, come on, knock it off. You know, everything's fine. And we were outside, and it was a beautiful, bright, sunny day, but there was a light breeze. And finally, I went up to the staff and I said, I think she needs a blanket around her feet, because between her socks and her pants, there was probably 6 inches they had pulled up. And as we age, I mean, I'm 64 now, I get colder than I used to. And they were like, oh, she's fine. I'm like, she's not fine. I said, you get a blanket, or I'm going to go to the director and ask for a blanket to put around her legs. So they reluctantly went and got a blanket, and we put it around her legs, and she stopped and she just beamed, you know, and it was just, she was cold. She was just cold. Another time I remember being, and again, this can happen to any of us. I mean, I've missed moments myself. You learn over time. There was this little woman, and she was Asian, And every supper, the staff would set the tables, you know, with the napkins and the silverware. And she would go around and grab them all off. And the staff would get so frustrated. They'd be chasing her, give them back, you know, and then they'd have to get new ones because she touched them. And finally, I said, can I just take her for a walk? And she really didn't speak much English. And we just held hands and we walked. But I could tell she wasn't doing this to upset them. You could see she was smiling. She felt productive. And by the time we got back, she got a few words out. And I found out that her family owned a restaurant and she used to roll the silverware. And that's all she wanted to do. She wanted to help.
Yeah, I saw that too, Lori, a lot in when I did with my mom. She would she was a housekeeper when she was younger. That was her job. She did it fantastically. But she always had a list of all the things that she wanted to do for every single day. And she would, I called it TTT in my book, and it was basically touch, travel, and talk. Because she would touch things and move things and then she'd travel with them and she'd mumble and that was her talking. And I found that if I could get her to sit down and just give her a bunch of like men's handkerchiefs or something small like that, she would fold and unfold and you'd give her more or you'd mess them up and give them back. And she needed that tactile feeling, you know, we're talking about senses, but hers was touch and she needed to have things that she could feel and then do something where she felt she was contributing. And I can remember one day I had given her a basket of things just to kind of take out and fold, whether they were napkins or pieces of paper. And I can remember my dad going over there and taking one out because he was going to do it with her. And out of the blue, because she very rarely would say anything, she grabbed it back and she said, my job. And I was like, there you go. She knew that she was doing something that brought her back to that sense of independence and accomplishment. And those little things can make it so much easier. And I would tell my dad, give her the basket. Sit down, and now you can kind of close your eyes while you're in the room and, you know, enjoy a little bit of downtime. And they're hard to find out because it seems like sometimes we find a solution and you get to this nice plateau where things are like, oh, things are going along good. And then all of a sudden something changes and you have to like figure it out again.
Yeah. Oh, that is so true. But, you know, we all want to feel purposeful. We all want to feel like we're contributing and we belong. And that doesn't go away. You know, the memory and the words, the language, so many things can change, the mobility, but the feelings remain, I think, really strongly within the body. And that's what we have to learn to read better in terms of getting them into the correct space. What do you think are some of the most effective ways for families to communicate with somebody with dementia? Did you have any steadfast rules, or was that something that kind of shifted and molded over time too?
It did. I learned very early on, if I just said mom and tried to get my mother to have some kind of a interaction with me, her reaction was the same as if anybody else walked in the room. So I didn't feel special at all. And I found out very early on, if I would refer to her as Gail, she remembered her name, Gail. I don't know that she remembered that she was my mom. And my brothers never could get around to calling my mom Gail. It was just like, no, she's our mom. We can't do this. But I found that using her first name before I would say anything would kind of shift her focus towards me. And I would always, even if she was sitting, I would get down and usually sit on the floor right in front of her. So I, because she, they have a tendency a lot of times to hang their head a little bit and look down. And this way I was below her where I could get her eye contact right on me. And I found that by saying her name, being a little bit lower, getting that eye contact, and then lowering my voice and making sure there was nothing else that was competing with it at the time, helped to get the focus. Once I got the focus, I would always be very cognizant of making sure I spoke slower, that I used very simple language, and that I used a very calming voice, almost like now I'm kind of lowering my voice and making a little bit slower. And that would give her the ability then to like focus in and give me a little bit of eye contact. And with my patients, it would give me time to say the words and usually just a yes or a no type of question. Mom, are you cold? And it would take her a few seconds to process that sometimes. I might have to say it a second time, but if I was patient to wait for the answer instead of coming right back out, Mom, I asked you a question, are you cold? I wouldn't get any response. But with that patience, I would usually get either a nod or like a burr or, you know, some kind of an answer. And if she came out with something really bizarre, I learned very early on not to argue with my mom. She would hallucinate early on, and it was a very difficult time. She went through the anger hallucination stage, and would her facial features would turn from very serene to almost demonic at that time, and it would scare you. But I found out going back to my basics of the calming and, you know, trying to get that eye contact. And if she said she saw whatever she saw in the room, say, it's okay, Mom, you know, just trying to keep that calm demeanor and limit choices of yes and no, really was able to get out of her what I was looking for, some kind of interaction. And I actually would get to the point sometimes if I got close enough where she would flip my hair or pat my head. And to me, whether it was or not, I just chose to believe that that was Gail then being Mom. We had that interaction, and it's hard. It takes work, but the rewards are worth the work.
Well, and I think we have to get our egos out of the way. Like, my brothers sound like the same as yours. It's like, you know, I've been her son for 50 years. How can she not remember me? And even using Mom, she might know what that means. But then looking at you, you don't look like a small child anymore. Yeah. And if that's where she's back at, then that's confusing. Where by calling her Gail, she doesn't have to think where she is time frame wise. But she recognizes being called that over and over. And, you know, when she patted your hair, you know, head, or, you know, kind of played with your hair, to me, that says you're safe and mm-hmm. you know, comfortable with you. And those are the moments that just melted my heart. But
others
could never get to that point because they were so wrapped up in themselves, they couldn't see her needs had changed. You know, they didn't really want to deal with any of that. And it made me feel really sad, but there wasn't anything I could do. You know, I tried for a lot of years to change them, but you know, that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work. And every once in a while, you know, I'd venture out a little bit further and get like photo albums. I had, you can do them online, the photo books where you just have one big picture and it just says Gail, you know, or one big picture says Richard, you know, or her, my dad's name. And I found sometimes she would look through and, you know, do the tapping. And it was like, okay, that means, you know, she's connecting the picture to her mind through her little tap on the picture. And then to play with her. I ended up getting what I don't know what they are called now, but it was called a fidget blanket at the time. And there's all different ways they put them together. And it just gave me the ability to undo things and her to try to redo them. And, just trying to get that connection with the person makes communicating with them at a different level, because it's not through speech, but it's through some kind of play. And I'll tell you, Lori, I saw a lot of this with my two grandchildren, Noah, who passed away at 3, and Lauren was 4 and a half when he passed. But the years prior to that, I was watching them and able to bring them over to spend time with my mom. And it was so interesting to see two little children sitting on the ground with my mom, playing with her, and they had actually no inhibitions. They played with her as if she was just one of them. There was no prejudice, nothing. They would take her hand and take the square block and put it in the square hole. If she couldn't get it, they'd let her try for a while. And then they would be like, yeah. And she would be clapping her hands. And, I'm sure some people probably look at that and say, how could you do that to your mom? But I mean, that brought her great joy. And I'll tell you, it brought me joy. Those are memories that I choose now to look back on and forget the negative ones, because they made such a difference with everyone in that room.
No, I think kids teach us so much when it comes to caring, because like you said, they haven't been taught, to be prejudiced over things and to judge things. They just
Right.
want to play. One of my favorite moments, there's two of them that stick out in my head with my mom, and one was my mom still wanted to babysit and watch our daughter, and Tom and I were a little nervous, with that whole thing, and but it was so important to her. We made it work and we said, okay, for a couple of hours. And I would like bring over something for them to eat so she didn't have to cook. But walking in the door, and I remember standing in the threshold of the dining room, and there's my mom and my daughter, who's like 4 or 5 years old, and they're both coloring and they're both just beaming. And they lifted up their artwork and showed it to me, like there was no difference between them, and just beaming with pride of what they had accomplished. And I just thought, oh my gosh, I couldn't give that to my mom.
Yeah,
It was just
no.
really, really special, innocent, yet this moment in time. And my daughter only knew her grandma with dementia, and so she lived for 30 years with it, and they were just like two peas in a pod, all of my mom's life. But she learned compassion. She learned, not to judge. She learned to adapt. And those are really, really important lessons to learn. Another was when she was more in her end stages, we would go to the nursing home and we'd get a private room. And let's say we were having her birthday or a holiday. And the kids, some of them were little, so they're crawling underneath the tables. And my mom would kind of be dozing off in her wheelchair. And it never failed. Before they came out from under the table, 3 to 5 seconds prior, my mom would wake up and she'd just look at where they were going to come out. I mean, she was like asleep, but she was so in tune with
Yeah.
them. And I just found that fascinating. And then she'd giggle, and then she'd go back to sleep again. And
Yeah,
it's
that's something as adults we wish we could have, that level of a relationship with the people we're taking care of, but you can't. I mean, it's so different. And I don't care whether it's dementia, or even I saw that with my father-in-law who had terminal liver cancer. I mean, the way he would interact with me, the person that was taking care of him, very respectful and knowledgeable and knowing what was going on. But when his grandchildren were in the room, I mean, the energy that he drew from somewhere was just unbelievable. And it would last with him. I mean, it would pick him up, and it was almost like you had given him an injection of something.
Yeah, no, I totally understand where you're coming from. If anyone is just tuning in right now, we are talking with Darlene Fuchs, who is an author of this amazing book, Get in the Boat. And we have just been talking about so many different things right now, just lots of great tips in terms of how to communicate and using different strategies and learning how to adapt and things. And you can go to her website, which is getintheboatbook.com. She is on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, TikTok, and of course, her book is on Amazon as well. And all those links will be in the show notes. We are going to hear about QBlocks really quickly. They are a webmaster, and we'll be right back. I also want to introduce you all to QBlocks. They have been absolutely excellent to deal with. They have been in business for 18 years and they serve the globe. I can't say enough good things about this company. I've had a lot of bad experiences. I don't know about you with tech companies. They have made a very complicated process very easy. And their staff is so kind, so polite, so respectful to work with. And, you know, when I am frustrated and ready to pull my hair out, they just smile and tell me everything's going to be okay. And they really are just on top of the communication, which alleviates so much stress as an owner when you're dealing with tech issues. You can get a 10% discount. Visit them at QBlocks at CUE. BLOCKS.com, or you can email them at letstalk@qblocks.com. For that 10% discount, just put Lori, Lori, in the inquiry form. And again, I don't think you'll be disappointed. I surely haven't been. I can't rave enough about this company. And that's kind of rare these days.
So, Darlene, I wanted to ask about caregivers and how do they ensure safety in the seniors' home? You know, what types of things should they change in terms of their environment or consider to change?
You know, I've put that question out even on some of my Facebook sites, and it's really interesting because safety is a really big issue, especially when someone is having a hard time just navigating and getting around. It goes everywhere from, like we had talked at the very beginning, with trying to get the clutter that they may have to navigate around in the home, pushed away so there's more open spaces for them to navigate. I found with my mom that it was very important that as she, because she was still very mobile, to be able to have furniture placed in such a way that she could put her hand out and balance herself if necessary, because there's always that fear of your loved one falling and then having to deal with the ramifications of what if they get hurt and how to take care of that. Another thing that I found important too, especially with sundowning and stuff that happens in dementia, is making sure that the lighting is such that as they are moving around or as you're moving around, even is to have the light bright enough so that you're not going to trip over something if you're helping them to move from one place to another, and to to help the tripping hazards for them also. A lot of people will say, no slip floors, but I found that a lot of times with the shuffling that goes on as one either is getting and later stages in dementia or the end of what I would say a terminal illness, is that shuffling can a lot of times, depending on their footwear, can grab. And then, especially with dementia, with flooring, I noticed with my mom when they were when she's transitioning from like a light color to a darker color of the flooring, the depth perception started declining, and it got to a point that it was she actually felt that she was going to be stepping down a stair or down another level when she would look at that darker area and, you know, would tap with her foot and we would have to help her until I realized really what was going on. There's, other than those like basic things for navigating around one's house, if you have a loved one that wants to get up and wander, or you're having problems with them staying in bed at night, you can put on light sensors. So when they get up to go to the bathroom during the night, if they're still able to do that, that the lights will automatically go on enough that they'll be able to have safety going to and back from the bathroom. And then I would say securing the exits, making sure that your loved one isn't going to be walking out of the house at night when you're asleep and you're unaware that, you know, they've gotten up for whatever reason. There's just a lot of things I find with technology nowadays that can help with safety. Even the things like they have, you know, the pill organizers that, you know, so you make sure you're giving the pills at the right time. There's, you know, the list can go on and on, but I think first safety in the home and then using technology features so that you can make your life as a caregiver a little less easier so you're not constantly having to run and check on your loved one.
Yeah, you know, this morning I just did a recording with my dementia chats group, people living with dementia, and it was all on safety and identifying issues and resolutions. And that won't be out probably for a couple more weeks, but they had so many. And I know, like you said, the list can go on and on, but one that stuck out to me was Craig Hanke mentioned a wristband. And I'm a big believer both the person with dementia and the care partner should have wristbands. But there was one, and I think it was like $24.95 or $29.95. And it was just kind of a silicone, you know, wristband, but it had, you know, name, and it had, you could put on like if you had dementia or heart disease or, you know, whatever. And then it had a phone number to the company, but it had a QR code. So any EMS could scan it and get access to all your medical records, your DNR, you know, the whole nine yards there, which I thought was really neat. He said it took about 2 hours to set up, but in case somebody takes a tumble in the house or, you know, you get in an accident or somebody wanders off, you know, that can be helpful on so many levels. But I think that your partners don't realize they need that too, because if something happens to them, people need to know that they're caring for somebody, you know, and who are those emergency contacts. So,
great advice.
The items you mentioned. And then I just learned of a new technology. It's called Nomo Smart Care. And it's a sensor, but a lot of people don't want to be videoed and they don't want audio. And it just reacts to motion. So you can tell if somebody got out of bed, you can tell if somebody went to the bathroom, you know, if they were in the refrigerator, if they were over by where the pills were, you know, if they're where they're normally sitting, if they've left. So you can have this monitoring without really people getting paranoid about their eavesdropping, you know, on everything that I'm doing. And it's just really for safety, and they can figure out normal patterns. So even if someone is going to the restroom a lot during the night, now they might think maybe they've got a bladder infection because that, you know, or something's up with them in some other fashion, because that's not a norm, you know, a norm of their behavior and stuff. So it's endless, and things just keep coming out all the time, which I think is exciting and is good. But the difficult thing is people finding out about all of these different aspects too.
Yeah, it is. And it's through sharing a lot of times that we, you know, it jogs our memory. And you know, I have a lot of caregivers, you know, that feel guilty for not having done something like that. And, you know, I always go back to none of us planned on being in this situation. And we only know as much as we know based on the knowledge that we've already learned. And as we all go through the process, we pick up on tips like you've just mentioned, a couple new things that you learned. And it's like, we can't beat ourselves up and say, oh, I should have done that because this wouldn't have happened. If we didn't know about it at the time, how are we supposed to be able to purchase it or to make that available to our loved one? So yeah, we get smarter and we just have to be able to, like you're doing with your show, is share the information to other people so they don't have to go reinventing the wheel all over again.
Yeah, that's one of the things I always ask my audience is to be a giver of hope. Like, click, and share, because you don't know who in your sphere of influence needs this information, because it's not something that people readily talk about. And yet it's so important. And so often we can set these things up before a crisis hits so that the routine is established and then it's not this crisis mode of everybody learning or having to find something out. And that's one of the reasons too we created Dementia Map, our global resource directory, is, you know, it doesn't cost anything. And there's like 150 different categories people can search. And, you know, we just want it to be easy access if it's profit, yeah, nonprofit, government agency, or a family caregiver or person living with dementia who, like you, has written a book, who has a YouTube channel, who's created a Facebook page. All of those things are important to be able to share, because we all need different things at different times and we like different medians and relationships. So it's just very critical. Now, Darlene, I can't remember. Are you part of Dementia Map yet?
No, but I will be. I mean, if we're offering hope, that's great, but we should not ever stop learning. Because then you get to a point, what else are you going to offer? If you can't offer more information, then you've come to a standstill. And I think we should all be out there with our connections, like you said, just being a sponge to get more information and just to leak it out and pass it on.
Well, and I think it's easier to absorb that way when it's heard. You can hear the inflection, you know, of how it worked and why, you know, the stories behind it. Because when we keep just going, oh, read this, do this, you know, the list is so long. You just all of a sudden you go, I just can't do any more of this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have it in me. But a conversation that is friendly and open and is helpful, most people will find time for that.
Yeah.
And find it comforting. It's caring for the caregiver, you know, at that point. Which is a huge aspect that a lot of times people forget how important that is. How did the rest of the family work with this? Were they involved in her care? And
I think I have two brothers that were very similar to yours.
Okay.
My one brother lives in Newfoundland, Canada, and the other one lived in Maine at the time and was always out sailing. So very much not part of taking care of mom and helping dad out. My dad did an amazing job helping take care of my mom. I don't think he ever changed a diaper or boiled a kettle of water for tea, but he definitely learned, just like everybody else did, that you just have to jump in and do what's best for your spouse. He was an amazing caregiver. He always would say, keep me alive as long as my love of my life is here with me. And after that, I really don't care. That was his purpose. And he fulfilled what I would say was maybe his obligation, but he fulfilled his purpose miraculously.
Yeah, my dad was like that too. I mean, you never saw him cook or do the laundry. I mean, stuff was the guys, the inside stuff was the girls, and he just picked up everything, you know, and didn't ever squawk about it. And I remember asking him one day, how are you doing? And he's like, this is the least I can do. She's done this for the whole family all her life.
Yeah. And my dad's journal, I can remember him saying once, he said something to the effect that in the case of dementia, referring to my mom, the game of marriage is over. Now the vows become real. And it's like, for him to have that, I think that kind of faith is probably what got him through some really difficult times. I mean, he was no saint, and he went through depression, and he went through self-doubt and all of the things that caregivers all go through. But in his heart, I think he really knew that it was the disease, and he chose always to believe for those few seconds here and there that his love was still there. And she had somehow been kidnapped by dementia. But I mean, that was his choice to believe that, and it got him through.
Yeah. Well, and you see those moments of lucidity that just pop out of nowhere.
Yeah.
That lets you know that they are still in there, that, you know, your souls are still connected. But you never know when they're going to pop out, and you can do something exactly the same thinking, okay, I'm going to repeat this, and she's going to pop out. She's going to be there. And it's like flatline.
It's the times you least expect it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in my dad's case, he did journal. And that's what the book is based on. And I think that was his way of just trying to vet sometimes instead of yelling at my mom, yelling at his journal. And my mom knew enough that I guess he would spend enough time with the journal because she would go over sometimes and say my story. And when he wasn't around, she would find it sometimes and rip a page out or scribble on it or something. So she definitely knew that his time was being taken away with what he was doing. And, but you know, sometimes you need to have something like that where you can journal as a way of releasing your stress, or even being able to look back and say, how have things been going? Are they getting worse? Are they getting better? Am I doing better? Or have there been moments that have stood out that I'd like to do more of certain things? And I think sometimes we should all jot things down, because it does. It gives us a chance just to breathe it out if we don't have somebody else to talk to.
Yeah, well, it acknowledges the emotions without having to tell the world. But I think nowadays people are worried, if I write it down and somebody runs across it, you know, how is that going to be interpreted? Because everything's taken literally. And sometimes you just have to vent whatever those feelings are and say whatever you have to say. Not that you're, you know, going to kill somebody, but you just feel like you're going to rip your hair out, or, you know, commit suicide. Or, I mean, people have all this wide range of feelings, and it's not like they're going to act on them, but they just have to write them down to go, okay, I'll let that go now. I got that out of my system. And then also to write down those moments of joy, you know, those moments of gratitude. That come.
The only problem is my dad wanted me to take his journals and write a book. But as his daughter, I had a hard time reading some of the journals, not just because of the caregiving part of it, because I witnessed that and experienced that with him. But from a man's point of view, when he was telling what it's like to change in how you approach intimacy and the feeling of self-worth from a man's point of view, and, you know, and love, it was like, oh, I really didn't want to read that. But it's like, well, you know, obviously he wanted people to know about it. And I tried to put it in such a way that it was still sensitive to his overall feelings. But I can see where you were saying people are hesitant to write things down because who's going to look at them?
Well, and I think kudos to your dad, because that is a conversation that needs to be had. You know, because people don't focus on the man's view when caring for their wives, because so often it's the wives caring for their husbands that we've always heard about, just because they haven't wanted to talk about it or haven't wanted to go to a support group or whatever it is. And we're seeing a lot more men come out and be involved and being open about talking about it. I see a lot more men in my support groups now than I ever used to. And, you know, they're like, thank God that there's this group where I can talk openly. And it's interesting, because then they're also getting the perspective, you know, of the women in the group too, And they're like, oh, I feel that too. And everyone's kind of shocked how similar they are, even though they're different, you know, coming from different angles. So I think the honesty is important. Because I don't think we can make sustainable change if we aren't inclusive and if we're not honest. We'll never get support if we don't tell people what we need and what it's really like. I mean, that's just the bottom line with that. So we need strong people like your dad and yourself, you know, to come out and share those stories. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And it's not just a disease that's for women, you know?
No, not at all. So what would be the top like three things that you would say people could expect out of your book?
Oh, the top three things. Well, definitely it's unfiltered. It's not a book that is trying to be some type of a medical journal. It is just very deeply personal about my dad's journey and shedding light on the complexity that of caregiving that he went through with that very intimate perspective from a man. It kind of explores his natural desire as a spouse to try and mend my mom. I think a lot of us go through that. And then his sober realization that there is not a way to mend my mom, that it was just a challenge that was out of our control. There wasn't a fix for it. You just had to go through it. And that's why he chose the title, Get in the Boat, because his analogy, there's a caregiver educator called Helen Brown, and she goes through to different places for to educate the caregivers that are in facilities that are in a paid caregiver role. And they worked on the skit with that title, and it basically put Gail in the boat and him telling them that you can't pull it, you can't push it. All you can do is get in that boat and have the oar and navigate as best you can around the rough waters, but that person is leading you and you have to take their lead. And other than that, I would say it's just brutally honest. And when you go through and you read about how he endured through loneliness and self-doubt and understand maybe more some of the unique difficulties of a person that is affected with dementia, at the end, I feel like you're going to be forever changed because it's different. And at the same time, you'll go on a roller coaster. You'll be given a reward and it will be taken away from you. And I think that's how life is. And it just has to be told that way.
Well, and I agree with you. I think that's how life is. And yet when dementia hits, everyone thinks we're going to hit this perfect even realm. You know, and when you mention the brutal honesty, I would imagine also with that is deep love and commitment, you know.
Absolutely.
Through and that is so, I think, so important. Any last advice you'd like to give to new caregivers who are just starting to navigate?
I would say be loving to yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's only through that and that you can actually be a very good caregiver. Take time for yourself. My dad gave up the game of golf until he was encouraged to go play it. And yes, the first time out, every time he would tee up, he would be worried about is somebody taking care of her? What's going to happen if she falls? And that self-guilt got to be really, really bad. So you need to love yourself first in order to be able to love the other person. You have to take time. And I know everyone tells you, take time for yourself. But if that means giving someone a box of handkerchiefs to fold up so that you can just put your headset on and listen to some calming music or open up the door and take a 5-minute walk around the house, you need to be able to take a breath for yourself. And as far as new caregivers, that's what I would say is the most important when you get started, because the beginning is only the beginning. It usually does not get easier as it progresses.
Good advice. And, you know, I was one that didn't take that advice, and I didn't realize until I was totally empty. My soul was like totally empty because I was so focused on everyone else but myself. And then I took time to be with friends who didn't give up on me and kept calling and kept calling. And it was at that meeting where I thought I would only stop in for 10 minutes, kind of get them off my back and leave. I stayed for 2 hours and we laughed and we cried, but they filled me up. And I was like a new person walking out that door. And I had no idea how empty I was and how exhausted I was and how much I needed, you know, my needs to be met, my soul to be full, so that I could care better. Because we can't care well when we're exhausted, when we're frustrated, when we're at our wit's end, you know. So
critical. Yeah, I always tell people, like, when those thoughts do start to creep in, and they will, I mean, it's inevitable, they get in the way of your own self-care. And when they do, I always say, stop. It's time for an attitude adjustment. My life matters. I need to ask for help. And if you don't get the help right away, ask again. And then when you do, do something that you enjoy, because you need to be able to relax. And we all do things that might not, you know, turn out right, but it's okay. We have to forgive ourselves with all of our flaws and just learn to be kinder to ourselves, easier on ourselves, and know that we don't have to be perfect. I mean, that perfection is not going to come.
That's so true. I like you, sold real estate, and for a long part of my journey, well, my mom was living with dementia for 30 years. And I remember seeing a client, this was after my mom and dad had passed. And I saw him at a bar and had a drink with him. And the woman stopped, we were in the middle of a conversation, and she stopped me and she said, "I just have to tell you this." And I said, "What?" And she said, "You have beautiful blue eyes." And I said, "Oh, thank you." And she said, "Lori, when you worked with us and you sold us several homes over the years, your eyes were black. They were so dark. Your personality was kind." But she said, "I realize now how much your soul must have been drained."
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
No, but she said, you know, "You've got this sparkle," and we don't realize we've lost that because we don't focus on that. We're not looking for that at all. And the other thing I think with that whole self-care business is when you had mentioned we need to know what we like. I remember when my dad died and when my mom died. I was better when my mom died because that was several years later, but I didn't know what I liked because I was so in the thick of caring for everyone else. And I had to kind of explore, like, people are like, "What do you mean you don't know what you like?" That hasn't been on my plate. I haven't, that hasn't come into my mind in, you know, years. I really don't know what I like. I mean, I like my family. I like, you know, this and that, but it wasn't really anything that was for just me, because even with my family, you're still caring for them. And so it was a very interesting experience. So keeping those ties alive, I think, are important. Well, in wrapping up, you know, Darlene, this has been just a great conversation. We've blown by the hour, which I knew we would. Again, her book is called Get in the Boat, a memoir of love, loss, and the dance with dementia. And you can find that on Amazon, or I'm sure you can go to your website, which is getintheboatbook.com. She is on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and TikTok as well. And I'm just so grateful that you were here with us today. So thank you.
Thank you, Lori. I had a great time. Anytime we can share together is a blessing.
I agree. In wrapping up for our audience, I hope you learned as much as I did. I love doing these shows because, you know, the knowledge out there is endless, and we just have to connect each other to to one another, and certain things are going to spark at different times for each of us. And as always, I ask you to be a giver of hope, you know, like, click and share, you know, let other people hear this conversation, and hopefully that will give them some comfort. It'll give them some ideas, and it'll give them the courage to ask for help. And yeah, hopefully they'll pick up on some new resources and acknowledging they do need to take care of themselves, and that this isn't, you know, class 101. This is going to be something that's going to go up and down like a roller coaster, and you're going to need to be fluid. But there are so many beautiful life lessons that you can learn that it will improve all of your life if you choose to step in and step up and get in the boat and follow their lead. So thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Lori.
Hey everybody, Jared Sebestier, host of Retire Repurposed. This podcast is dedicated to help people transition into fulfilling and purposeful retirements. Retirement is a big life change. In fact, the two most dangerous years of a person's life are the year they were born and the year they retire. Few people could just flip the switch from working a career 30 or 40 plus years, retiring on Friday, without methodical steps to living what we call a repurposed retirement. To listen now, search Retire Repurposed on your favorite podcast platform, Senior Resource, or Life Audio.